My name is Molly Browning. I am the MBA most recent past president. We're lucky to have a couple members of our board and former past presidents in the audience as well. So I'm going to ask them to raise their hands. Ben Bailey is your current treasurer. Oh, wait, there's a slide for this. There you go. Steve, raise your hand, is your current vice president. And Doug Wilson is your past president from a couple of years ago. So thank you all for being here. Thank you all for coming. This is the first time we've done this as an organization, as MBA. We are the Master Brewers Association of America. If you don't know us, we're the oldest technical brewing organization in North America. We are just here today to gather, to enjoy some community. I would like to introduce our local district here, the District Philly, in a second. But we're also here today to raffle off MBA membership and MBA books. So if you put your card or name in the picture and you are still here, you are one of the lucky ones that are eligible for a free MBA membership and some books to add to your collection. So, yeah, that's a little bit about us. We're our brewing technical organization. That's a bit about the membership. And then just a couple of quick national announcements before I hand it over to Matt. We are a national organization, but we have 26 districts globally, mainly in North America. So we have three in Canada, we have one in Venezuela, and then we have a smattering across the U.S. You don't need to be a part of a local district, but if you are, you get to enjoy some really great community, some really great local events. I was just at the District New York meeting last week, and that was quite fabulous. We have District New York President Chris Kuzme in the back. Chris, raise your hand. And then, Kyle, aren't you District Northern California? Yes, I got that one right. That's District Northern California President over there. Matt is District Philly President. Do we have any other district leadership here? Tim? You're District Michigan President? Wow, you wear many hats. Tim is also chair of our National Technical Organization, which leads me to this. Tim is part of the planning for our wonderful MBA conference that is happening in Virginia Beach from October 22nd to 24th. This is also the current president, Brian Favors' hometown at his home brewery. So we're really excited about that. One of the speakers on the panel today is the keynote for the conference as well, so that's fun. Just to highlight a couple of other things, we have courses. We'll be having all three courses this year, so the brewery maintenance course, the packaging course, and the brew malt science course. The brew malt science course, we just hired a new course director. You might know him. His name is John Mallett. He wrote the book on malt, among other things, so, you know, we think he's kind of qualified. We also just want to highlight the Technical Quarterly. We have a new editor-in-chief, Harmony. Raise your hand. Harmony will be moderating today's Ask the Brewmasters, so please come with questions. But we are also looking for great submissions to the Technical Quarterly, so please consider submitting. These are a couple of TQ highlights. So you see we have a range of topics that, you know, that are highlighted in the TQ. We also have the Master Brewers podcast. We actually have two podcasts. We have one, this is the English language one. We also have the Spanish language one, which Christian, I don't know where he is, there he is. Christian is the host of, so please come and say hi to Christian as well. And then we have our books. So these are just a couple of the highlighted books, and of course, we are auctioning or raffling off some books today. So I'm going to hand this over now to Matt, and he's going to talk to you about the collab beer that we are pouring today. Matt.
All right. Thank you, Molly. My name is Matt Farber, president of District Philadelphia. Welcome to Philadelphia. If you're from out of town, it's our pleasure to have you. If you're a Phillies fan, I'm sorry if you're as disappointed as I am with our team this year. I am wearing my Joint Phillies / cheesesteak shirt for this special occasion. Raise your hand if you had a cheesesteak yet in Philly. Good. Still a couple more to go. One of the beautiful things about Philadelphia is that, if you didn't know, is our sandwiches, right? We have great bread in Philly. And so as District Philly, we were looking for some new ideas to try to bring our community together, to get brewers, both big and small, into the same room, while engaging with some local collaborators from some adjacent industries. And so we reached out to a district member, AJ Stoll, from Bonesaw Brewing Company. They're down the road from my place of employment, Rowan University. And we reached out to James Lissio, whose family owns Lissio's Bread. Lissio's is one of the big bread producers in the region. And so chances are, if you had a cheesesteak, it may have been on a Lissio roll. Get it seeded, by the way. And so it was our real pleasure to bring together district members to Bonesaw Brewing Company to brew our official CBC collaboration beer. So it is a rye lager that James brought about 100 pounds of stale, upcycled bread that he had sliced for us and then threw into a toaster. So we really wanted to get some mired kind of character from that toast to hopefully not just add carbohydrates, but perhaps a little bit of flavor as well. So if you look on the left, that's AJ and James and a couple others who might be here. And Bonesaw is really great because they have a nice-sized mash press. So not a lot of 20 hectoliter breweries have a mash press. They do. That allowed us to not be as concerned about throwing a bunch of bread into our mash. And so you can see we kind of threw all of our bread or all of our toast in on foundation water, got it good and hydrated before we mashed in the rest of the way. And you can see kind of what was left behind in the press afterwards. So that was a great experience for everyone involved. And so here's a look at a bunch of the companies and breweries that helped with this collaboration. So if you didn't try the beer, please do. It's on the back corner. Feel free to like stand up while I'm talking and get a beer. I'm completely okay with that. And so if not, when the panel's done, please help yourself to some more. We also have some more Philly District brews that were donated to this event. And so we thank you for coming out. And District Philly is happy to welcome you to Philadelphia. James is hanging around, so if you have any questions about bread, about his process, they have a huge operation that is really, really cool. And so if you want to take a sidestep and talk about bread, please, James will be here after the panel so you can chat about that really cool adjacent industry. So thank you guys for your time. I don't want to take up any more. And so it is my pleasure to welcome Harmony to the floor. And I guess our panelists should come up as well.
Thank you. I am Harmony Bettenhausen. I am actually, so Molly just introduced me. I am the new MBAATQ editor-in-chief. So we do welcome your submissions or any submissions you are thinking about. One of the things that we are thinking about at the MBA annual conference, or that I'm thinking about, is to also have a session about how to prepare your, and we've done this in the past, actually, Laura and Molly and I have done this in the past, talking to people about how to prepare research in the brewery for publication. So if that would be useful to you, I think it would be fun to help you prepare your research in the brewery for publication for us. Not self-serving at all. So today we have the Ask the Brewmasters panelist. We have three of our four panelists up here. I'm sure that Jason will get here shortly. And I'm going to go through and let them introduce themselves. And then we have a Slido QR, and you can ask them questions. Any question at all. Everything is on the table. So first we have Dr. Laura Burns from Omega Yeast, Dr. Glenn Fox from UC Davis, Ben Bailey from Trogs Brewing, and eventually we will have Jason Perkins from Allagash Brewing. Do you have a, okay, go ahead, Laura.
Hello?
Okay. Hi, everybody. If you haven't met me before, I'm Laura Burns, Director of Research and Development at Omega Yeast. I come to Brewing with kind of a background in yeast biology. So I did my PhD at Vanderbilt University studying kind of the basic cellular mechanisms behind, you know, how the yeast respond to their environment and regulate their gene expression program. So it went from real nerdy to real practical when I started brewing. I left grad school looking for kind of the next step, decided I didn't want to work in biotech, but I thought brewing was a really good way to apply my PhD. And from there, you know, five years brewing as, you know, director of quality, head brewer roles, and then back to the bench at our doing R&D at Omega Yeast. So, and I've been there for 7 years, doing my best to make science approachable.
Hi, my name is Ben Bailey. I started brewing back in 1996 at Live Oak Brewing Company in Austin, Texas. After I worked there, I went to Vine Stefan. Got my Braumeister diploma and came back, worked for Miller Coors for a couple of years. And I've been at Trogs now for 16 years, which adds up to way more time than I like thinking about. But here we are. I'm the quality manager there. And I've been involved with MBA for at least around 15 years as well, through presentations and volunteer work, and now as the treasurer.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Glenn Fox. I'm the Anheuser-Busch Endowed Professor at UC Davis, carrying on a traditional of international academics in the brewing program there, whether they like it or not. Sometimes they don't like it, but I don't care. So my background is more upstream, coming from the barley and malt, which I think, is that barley and malt important and bread important in our production? So I've done a PhD in barley genetics associated with endosperm texture, how maltable the grain could be and those sorts of things. Coming from Australia, I was in the Institute of Brewing and Distilling, and I still am on the International Committee for the Brewing and Distilling, but also had been involved in ASBC and MBAA for way too long, more than 20 years, coming over here for conferences, because the rest of the world was seeing how the craft scene was hitting the ground and then starting to really go off, and the rest of the world was going, let's see what's going on. We weren't spying, we were just interested to see how things are happening and all the strategies that were in place to see the success of all these new breweries, and the accessibility to supply chains, availability of equipment and technologies and where that was coming from. So I was at the University of Queensland and we set up a pilot brewery, and again we were training brewers that wanted to get into the industry in that context as well. So that's a little bit about me.
Thank you. Well, you can keep the mic because the first question might be directed a little bit towards you.
Oh, dear.
So, this is our Slido QR. If you've got questions for us, scan the QR code, ask a question. It's all anonymous. You don't have to worry. Don't get raunchy right now. It's the first day. Okay, first question we have for you. How are extreme environments impacting grain production and malting quality? What have you guys seen?
I think we could also, some of the information I'll share is probably all my perspective on this can apply to hop production as well, because the hop production is happening over the summer and we have noticed summers may be increasing in temperatures. So that overall change in, dare I say, climate? Am I allowed to say that? Is this a safe space? I can say climate change. I did have a project rejected from USDA recently because I had those two words in the title, and they rejected the project and they said, can I rework the proposal? So I changed climate change to extreme environments. No problems. Anywho, I think that's probably a better descriptor of what's potentially coming. And even colleagues in Europe are talking about this in Copenhagen, Denmark, and Germany. In Germany, with the Rhein-Heisgebut, they're really concerned about potentially having to import materials. So I think it's facing the grain industry globally as well as the hop industry. I think it's going to impact production, but to a more subtle extent, it will impact quality, and in ways that we don't routinely measure. And the maltsters may not even know until they've sent malt to the brewer And then the brewer will have comments around, I'm not getting conversion, or I'm not getting the foam stability I was expecting. So there will be these really subtle changes or subtle quality variances that we're not measuring routinely. Now, we have very mature industries. We're suddenly not going to bring in new methods. The maltsters do not want us to tell them to measure something differently. It's just a case of we have to go through this process, but be aware that there will be seasons that there's more of a risk with some things. The maltsters will have their eye on the ball there and knowing there's a greater risk. Hopefully they'll then be ready to have those conversations. I've done some malt testing for some maltsters, and then they've been able to, based on the data I've given them, on some more deeper quality, they've then had conversations with their brewers about changing their mashing schedules. So this is where you really have to have a very good relationship with your maltster. Be on good speaking terms with your maltster, even though the maltsters usually get blamed for everything. Anything goes wrong in the brew house, and we were talking about PYF, which is a topic we don't talk about much in our industry, and the first thing we do is blame the maltsters or blame the barley. So have a good conversation with your maltsters. Be good friends with them. Go on a barley field walk. I know that the brewers like to go on hop walks. Walk a barley field so you know what that experience is like. Go on a barley harvest so you, again, know what that experience is like. Really understand the whole value chain of all your raw materials. And if you look at life cycle analysis, the amount of water we use at different points in the grain and hop production, transport systems, malting, brewing, packaging, transport, that end is really having to take the hits in terms of water use and energy use. So they're the ones who are going to be probably feeling it first, but they're already aware of that because they're already experiencing some extreme environments. So I think it's happening. I'm retiring in a few years. If they want to kick me out, fine, I don't care. But climate change is real. I think we can't assume it's always warming, because even now you probably experienced a warm winter, but suddenly we're in spring and it's cold. Things are just shifting, and they're shifting unpredictably. And that makes it even harder. And again, something we probably don't, as brewers, think of as too often, is farmers are business people as well. They are custodians of the land. They want to protect the land and make sure it's still a viable business. So they're very keen to do their very best job. So they're at the front end of that. You know, with extreme droughts, suddenly they don't have a crop. And they've done nothing wrong. It's just Mother Nature has thrown them a curveball. Can I use a baseball analogy? Is that okay? Is that what it is? They've done nothing wrong. Same with the hop farmers. When it gets wildfires and the smoke contaminates the hops, the hop farmers have done nothing wrong, but they're business people. So they're taking huge risks. So we really have to understand and appreciate that end of our business. So if you can engage with more with hop farmers, engage with the maltsters, and then have some conversations with some barley and hop, barley and wheat, and maybe even Kernza farmers, Fonio farmers, sorghum farmers, rice farmers, wherever you are, go out and meet those people.
Yeah.
I'm Jason Perkins from Allagash Brewing, and I'm very sorry I am late.
It's okay. Do you have any comment on extreme environments and how it's affecting the barley or any other grains that's
I missed most of it, but I guess one thing that came to my brain as I was listening to it is just, you know, I think it's a balance with preference on variety in barley or wheat or hops in general, that we as brewers really like to focus on flavor and focus on, you know, what works for us from that perspective. But, you know, we work with some local farmers in Maine quite a bit, and they have experimented with different varieties of barley, for example, to grow in different climates. And we always let them figure that out first, and the flavor comes later. I'm not saying it's not important, but first and foremost, the farmer has to make a profit on the crop, has to do well agronomically before it can go any further. So even though, yes, of course, we want that to produce something that tastes good, it's all meaningless if it doesn't do well long term. And same could be said for hop varieties. You know, I think it's good to look at hop varieties as the ones you think smell and taste good, but look at yields too, because that's what matters. Yeah, they can charge more if the yields are low, but more importantly is that has to be long-term sustainable. So it's good for us all to kind of have an understanding. You know, when the hop reports come out, you look at that stuff and see what acreages are growing, which hop varieties are yielding better than others, and that's just as important as anything else as aroma and flavor can be.
All right, we can move on to our next question. Can you elaborate, again, this is for anybody, can you elaborate on the state of craft brewing in other countries?
Yeah, I guess I've been a little travel bee lately, but I went to China the last 2 weeks, so got to experience a lot of variety across, you know, kind of the old and new. So, yeah, in Asia, I think the market is very young for craft beer, and a lot of their mainstays are, they brew a lot of wit and Hefeweizen and lager on a macro level. But even the new craft brewers are always carrying a wit or a Hefeweizen along with now their experiment, which is mainly hazies. There's a lot of hazies. And fruited sours are getting pretty trendy there, but what was interesting in China is just to see their approach to it, because I had one of the best, I don't even remember what the fruit was, but it was a Chinese citrus and paired with like a jasmine tea and in a fruited sour. And, you know, not something I necessarily would expect to have here, but was their take on it. And it was really beautiful. It was one of the best beers of the trip. So just fun to see, you know, their own influence and their own really kind of customer preference, what's really trending in their market, and see how they're approaching it. So it's big. It's big in China and growing. And even the younger, so the transition from what I heard, obviously I'm listening to a lot of people telling me, and I'm not too informed, but the drinking culture there was a lot around baijiu, and it's been transitioning more to craft beer because the younger people don't want to drink baijiu anymore. So just an interesting, you know, we see some of the younger generation transitioning from beer to other things, but they're seeing the opposite trend. And recent trips to Europe, I think the regions I'm visiting are more traditional brewing regions, so just honing their craft, making better and better beer. You know, they're always just doing a step above what you'd expect. So that would be, that's a very mature market in their approach to it.
I don't have nearly as much experience with other markets as Laura does. I go to Germany every year. My family's there, or my wife's family, rather. They have a very interesting take on it, in my opinion. At least it was that way. It's changing some, but the initial interpretation of craft was that it had to be handmade in the literal sense. So, like, if you weren't hand-filling bottles, then it wasn't craft beer. If it didn't have a lot of oxygen because you weren't hand-filling your bottles, it wasn't craft beer. Which I was like, but it could be good beer. We could work on those parts and have an automated line.
In Italy, it's not craft if it's pasteurized. So there's all sorts of regional laws.
Yeah.
Interesting, too.
It's not craft if it's pasteurized?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, you can't pasteurize your beer in Italy if it's craft.
Interesting. Okay. Anybody else have any comments on that?
I'll say one more. I think on a trip to Australia, which you should talk maybe about, but the trends there are for lower ABV because there's very high tax on ABV. And the XPAs are amazing. So it's just fun to see when you're in another region too, like maybe we should look at what they're doing, because they've got it definitely under wraps when you're talking hoppy pale ale. They're doing a great job, so kind of inspiring too to see what other people do depending on kind of their constraints or their maybe access to really cool Southern Hemisphere hops.
In case anyone didn't know, I'm from Australia. So do not ask me about Foster's. It is an Australian beer. We haven't brewed it in Australia for about 30 years. It's actually brewed in Canada now. We can talk about Vegemite if you like. Molly's keen to talk about Vegemite. I think we're seeing similar trends in the Australian craft scene that we're seeing here. There's probably been more closures in recent times than openings. And that's due to a few things that you've all experienced in different ways, one or more of these factors that's influencing sales and production. But we are a bulk grain country and a bulk malt producer and exporter. So for a very long time, we've been a malt-based beer industry. We do grow some exceptional hops in Tasmania. And our seventh state, New Zealand, I'm from New Zealand here, that they won't appreciate me saying the seventh state is New Zealand. They call Australia the Big Island anyway. So some exceptional hops coming from that part of the world, and I know that some of those hops come over here when the Southern Hemisphere harvest is on, so April, May, there's some fresh hops coming from Australia. So I think there's a great relationship and synergy here, but I think Australia is still seeing, and other countries are still seeing very similar things. I spent a lot of time in South Africa and Kenya, and they've had the surge in craft. Initially, they went through the crazy IPA process, and they've all toned that back significantly. And now they're even just wanting to get out of IPAs in general. More lagers and pilsners, which I know a lot of people will be excited about, and just some standard ales, pale ales, ambers, and hefs. I think, yep.
All right, you can keep that mic. The next question is actually specifically for you.
Cool.
Dr. Fox.
Oh, shit.
Do craft brewers mashing at 65°C or above need to worry about lipoxidase?
Worry about lipoxygenase. Depends on the malt you're using. If you're using a well-modified malt, know that the kiln temperatures should have dealt with the lipoxygenase. There was actually a very interesting webinar by the American Malting Barley Association and the Brewers Association 2 weeks ago. And there's a couple of varieties that have been released around the world. One's from Carlsberg. Sapporo in Japan have released one. And I think one has come out of Canada that a lipoxygenase null. So we say it's a null. So it's missing that gene. So these barleys do not produce lipoxygenase, which is a notorious staling, an enzyme responsible for staling. So I think the higher temperature mashes, you're dealing with those enzymes. Only two key enzymes survive at 65 degrees for any period. So I think at the high temperature mashing, you're really eliminating some of those problems, but you might be introducing other problems because you might not be getting conversion if you don't know the gelatinization temperature of your starch.
All right. Thank you. Okay. As more NA beer is coming out on the market, we're concerned about microstability. After a few years have passed, are there any interesting developments, good or bad?
You handed me the mic, but I'm not really the best person to answer this. We don't make one. I just think you can't beat tunnel pasteurization for all NA products. So that should be always the standard across the board.
I'd agree with that. I think as far as interesting developments outside of stability, like there's some really good NA beers now, so that's something, which a lot of them. But, I mean, there's other products out there that I can't say from personal experience because we also don't make an NA. We've actually brewed some really good ones, which no one else has gotten to try because we can't package them to a level of stability that we're comfortable with bringing that out, even at the bar, like at the brewery. So, like, this was R&D level only, which we had to be very clear with our team when we started that project that, like, this is not going to make it very far unless we go whole hog and potentially put in a tunnel pasteurizer. So even though, because a lot of times at our brewery, we will have something that everyone's excited about that we're working on in R&D that makes it into the tasting room as, like, a sneak peek or whatever, like we'll have two kegs that we can put on draft. This was not one of those things that we were allowed to, but, well, we were very clear we would not allow them to have any of that beer, even though we were drinking it out of the tank, but just that's different. But yeah, the Lanxess has a product that potentially could be a solution. It's not 100% stability. It's not a tunnel pasteurizer, I guess is the best way to put it. And there's other products out there too, but yeah, we wanted a tunnel or don't do it.
Yeah, I think, well, we talked about this a lot, like, especially 3 to 5 years ago as the, like, MBA leadership. It was more how concerned are we, and also how much fear do you want to put into the craft brewer, which is, you don't want to restrict people from even getting involved. You just want to be transparent about what's required. So I think, you know, from the gold standard being pasteurization, we all said it, but tunnel pasteurization is a kill step. So you need something that effectively can eliminate anything that was introduced into the beer post-boil, right? That's your other kill step. So there's obviously, like, a need to make sure that it's food safe, so you have to have the right testing. Pasteurization isn't always going to work, right? You have to validate it. So how many PUs are you using? What's the, you know, beer brand that you're pasteurizing? It's not going to be consistent across all brands, so it's a lot of validation, food safety plan work. But I do think 5 years ago there were really options like for preservatives, which there are now. This kill step is still in question, whether they're a valid way, a method of killing all the microbial growth that you would experience. But I've seen the case studies, and they do show that they are effective. It just has to be, again, validated in every beer brand and every brewery with the challenge organisms you're going to experience. So still something that takes a lot of due diligence to get right. But yeah, the two products that are out currently in the U.S. market that in the pH range and in NA beer have been validated would be the Nagardo product and the Kyber product. Both are fungal antimicrobials, and they basically are pretty broad range against bacteria and yeast, but their effectiveness, again, has to be validated. Kyle. Yeah, and one side note, I don't know, she probably covered that. Kyle will probably cover this too, but, you know, everybody's approach is going to be a little bit different, again, based on what beer you're making, but also if you want to preserve hop character, there's ways of combining preservatives and pasteurization, so you're minimizing the cooked character. So, yeah, it's not just one way, and I think that's still the work that needs to be done on everybody's brand and how they're making their own beer.
I'll make one more addition to that. Everybody's making the beer their way. Like, we discussed how we wanted to brew the beer first, like whether we wanted to do a maltose negative yeast, whether we wanted to do de-alkalization, et cetera, et cetera. That all impacts how stable that beer is downstream, and whether or not if we did de-alkalization, whether we wanted to bring unfermented beer back in or barely fermented beer back in, or, you know, there's 100 ways to make NA beer. There's a million barrel brewery in northern Italy that does dealkalization, doesn't bring any sugar back in, and they don't tunnel pasteurize. They just package it. They don't have any issues according to them. There's nothing left in there to ferment. There's no alcohol. So, I mean, there's absolutely one less hurdle for microbes to grow, but, that beer is very different than one that's a stop fermentation or maltose negative, and the stabilization that you need to do for that is completely different.
You can keep that. The next question's for you.
Oh. Well, I was just going to ask a broader question. Sorry, Dr. Bettenhausen. For people that are producing NAs, do you consider the style you're producing and IBU levels, and does that change your pasteurization strategy or your alcohol levels and pH? all those three key things, IBUs, alcohol and pH, all can change influence stability. Do you alter any of your pasteurisation strategies with that, knowing those things, or do you just push a button and go, well, that's our strategy? It's just a question. Back to you.
Thank you. Okay, for Ben. Recently, your brewery has been producing a lot of different alternative beverages. How have you helped to manage all of this innovation?
That's a hard question because I don't feel like we manage it particularly well. I love doing it. Like, we do, coming up with gin recipes right now at the same time we packaged our first flat beverage in cans 2 weeks ago, and so on and so forth, and it's always something and three more things on top of that. From the planning stages, it's not so, like, that's just good organization, right? But from how we implement it at scale, it's a whole lot of ad hoc. Can we shove this in? Is there a way to dump it through the manway? Is there a way to, like, the systems aren't there to do it efficiently. When we make our FMBs, it's, I've forgotten, thousands of pounds of sugar per that we have to dump into the brew house by hand because we don't have a sugar handling system. So until we get one, we'll keep doing that, and we'll keep doing that as long as somebody probably doesn't get hurt, because it'll always be cheaper than the investment, which I don't like saying, but I mean, that's reality. I don't know. We were just trying to make it work, I guess, the best we can for most of these. Like, we have to come up with a plan. Like, if we're making hop water that we claim is gluten-free, we have to have a plan in place so that we know that we're going to CIP everything that's going through, so that we can say that's real, you know, that we didn't run it right after beer and get contaminated in the filler. So there's documentation and things that we do, but it's still very flexible with the systems that we have, which were to make beer and not FMBs or hop water or gin or anything else that we're doing now.
I think I always, because innovation obviously is a lot of what we do, I think my mentality is I don't want to hear about the problem. I want to hear about the solution. So it's always, you know, and if you get stuck, you're never going to move forward. You just have to have an attitude of, hey, there's a way, and we'll make it work. It's not going to be the best the first time. You need a solution, not just focused on the problem.
I will say, we do try and take it down the pike when we're even coming up with these crazy ideas, like for research and development. So, like, you can do anything in a two-barrel tank. I can stand on a step stool and dump things in and do all sorts of crazy things that are not realistic on a 1,000-barrel tank. So we do try, when we're making these decisions in R&D, we do try and think about, like, what's the impact once we go past the scale? Is this ever going to go to something that's scalable? And if it is, then we need to start thinking now about the plan and how we can pull this off. Because if it's a dead end, like, we really can't do it, then we have to have the discussion, like, is this worth a CapEx? Do we want to buy something to be able to make this possible? Because if we can't do it with the tools we have, then we need to figure that out before we even spend the time in R&D.
Well, speaking of R&D, I mean, the next question is sort of related. What is one bright spot or innovation that you are excited about in the brewing industry, like a style, a raw material, a philosophy, a piece of equipment, anything like that?
Well, first, to back up just a smidge, because I can relate to a lot of what you're saying, Ben. And we've, you know, with our R&D and innovation in general, even just beer, long ago we kind of set rules for ourselves around scalability of any, even we make all our R&D pilot batches in 10-gallon batches. And when we create an idea to even do on that system, we ask the question then, how would this look on our 30-barrel, 70-barrel brew house system? And often, typically what happens, the idea doesn't get shut down. It just gets altered, and we think about it differently. We approach it differently. Like, if the idea has freshly ground grapefruit zest, then that's great when you're doing a handful of it on a 10-gallon system, but we know what that looks like, a 70-barrel. So it doesn't necessarily shut the idea down, but it makes us think at that point, how would we solve that later? That sounds like we've got it all figured out. We don't always do that, but that's the, at least our intention, and that now gets into stuff that's not beer when we occasionally sample with that. And I was actually thinking about that for if all of you went to the keynote earlier, which was really, really great in a lot of ways, but he said something about that stuck out to me about, I forget how he said it, but don't always do things that are scalable. And I was like, okay, that's kind of the opposite of our philosophy. But there's something to be said there that if you have too many rules for yourself in R&D, then you're gonna limit yourself, right? You're not gonna be able to come up with what the next best thing is. In terms of new innovations, I guess I'm personally excited. You referenced it earlier. It's been happening in Australia for a while. Is this, you know, like 2.5% to 3.5% beers that still taste really good? We got one we're rolling out this summer in our tasting room, and that's been a really fun project. And part of that funness of that project is I got to go buy a whole bunch of ones from other people in the U.S. and kind of sample some cool beers. And, you know, it takes certainly a lot of skill to be able to execute a beer at that ABV that still has a lot of character and flavor to it. So that's something I'm excited about. I hope it catches on. It's all for nothing if the consumers don't buy them, but so we'll see how it goes long term.
If I could just add one thing about some raw materials, and it's a completely purposeful advertisement for a webinar next Wednesday morning, 8 o'clock Pacific time. Again, Amber and the BA are running a webinar where some bloke called Glenn Fox, dickhead I hear, and Birgit Skadhaus, Vice President Carlsberg, are going to do a presentation on DMS. And Carlsberg have released a variety that does not produce DMS. They've removed the DMS precursor. So I think there's still some things we can do in our raw material space without going the GM route, because the grain industry has made it fairly clear for our industry we're not going that route yet. So I think this is a good opportunity. I think we'll see more of these barley and wheat varieties coming along that will be really beneficial for maltsters and brewers. Laura might comment about some potential yeast as well. So I think from the raw materials, there's still things in the pipeline that will be of beneficial, improve efficiency, add flavour, and just add value to our industry.
I don't have anything on that.
No comment. I would just say, again, seeing the kind of evolution of hoppy styles into more sessionable, clear, not so hazy, is exciting for me. So I think the innovations in that set, more evolving towards, like, you know, some of the hop extracts are really interesting. Efficiencies and yields are going to be there. Also some clarity benefits. Just seeing that style evolve and just seeing how brewers can take it and make it a little bit more cost effective at the same time.
So I haven't seen this yet. So this is an innovation that I'm hoping to see applied at some point. But I've heard of other related industries like food packaging industries that are able to use AI for predictive maintenance. So you plug in, you know, all your pumps, all your everything, and it sees when it's pulling too much amperage, or like there's signs that things are about to go wrong, like you're about to burn a motor up or something else about to happen on a different piece of equipment, which sounds really cool because I hate putting out fires constantly, which I think a lot of other people can relate to. I don't know when that's like a commercial product that I can put in the brewery and afford, but it sounds like something that should be able to happen before too long.
Yeah, laying on top of that is getting more data in fermentation, having predictive, you know, instead of something you have to remedy, like actually preventing an issue. If you can have an early sign that you may have temp up right now because diacetyl is going to hit later, be nice to have some predictive ways of handling fermentation.
So when are we going to be done with hazy IPAs?
question I've been asking for a long time. And what is the next trend y'all think we need to be on top of? Jason, I think you just mentioned the low ABV.
We kind of walked over that. So I think we like non-hazy trend over on the low ABV, less intense, a little bit more balanced and sessionable, drinkable.
Yeah. So are we done? Can we call it quits?
Quit.
Perfect.
Or you know what? You don't have to quit. You just have to think about, how do we attract another customer? We're not just attracting those haze boys.
I think it's also, depends on your market and where you're at. There's a craft brewery in Germany that's doing nearly half of their volume in NA now because in their market, it's a tight house system. They're a new brewery. They don't own a bunch of property and buildings, right? But the regional breweries in their area don't make an NA beer, so they can sneak in the back door that way. I'm not saying that's a viable way to get in bars in the U.S., but think about those spaces that aren't being served and whether or not you can kind of sneak something in there. 2.75% beers, one of those at the moment.
Especially with drinking laws or driving laws.
I mean, that's kind of what we want. I mean, getting people through the door is what we've been talking about, especially younger drinkers, different generation. We're trying to appeal to more people that don't just want to be flat out drunk after one beer, or spend, $10 on a pint. If we're talking about getting people
It's certainly not a new trend because this beer style has been around a very, 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 very long time. Just brew some really good lagers. And I know so a lot of brewers are excited about getting back to brewing more lagers because they've gone from maybe only having one lager on their tap list to now they might have two or threes and a pilsner. And just do that really well, which I know you can do. And I think people will be excited about that because they really just moving away from IPAs really quickly.
Okay. I think this one's for you. With biotech potentially getting involved with yeast suppliers, how is this affecting the industry for legal reasons, legality, cost of yeast cultivation, and other aspects?
I think some of that might be, biotech getting into yeast. I think yeast are bringing biotech to craft beer, maybe. Not the other way around. I don't know. Both, maybe. I think certainly as Omega has approached, innovating with GM yeast, we've had a challenge because, our business needs to be sustainable. So I think probably this question is oriented more towards how do we continue to protect the innovation and see a future in bringing these new products to market. We've worked in, licensing structure. So if somebody is literally going to take a yeast slant and use the innovations that, we've put a lot of R&D and expense into developing and make that into scale, bypassing a need for us to supply any yeast to them any longer, that's where, we've worked in a licensing program to start ensuring that we have the support and return on our investment. So I think that's my probably only comment on that unless there's more questions.
If anybody wanted to, the question was anonymous. If somebody wanted to elaborate on the answer they were looking for with a question. Okay, no. Okay. This next one is about brewing wheat beer, I think. Would you recommend centrifuging with in the interest of sustainable haze, or should we just kick it old school by storing kegs upside down? #Flock problems.
Yeah, that's a challenging one. I think Jason might be the best answer. I would say, you know, the strategy is for, you know, getting stable haze in a whipped beer because the yeast is not haze positive, kind of have to rely more on the malt bill and, you know, other agents that can help, you know, in build a chill haze or a permanent haze that's not related to the yeast. So it's kind of a big challenge in that style. Our English strains are very haze positive, so they make a ton of stable haze in the hazy IPAs. It's a different scenario when you're looking at wit strains.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just add, like, this might be stating the obvious, but long-term haze stability is all about small things, really, really small, low molecular weight things. And typically, beer is full of heavier molecular weight things. So there's lots of ways to get that stuff out of the process, maybe in the brew house or in your cellars or the centrifuge that will help with that. But it's definitely not, there isn't, I will say in all our experience with Allagash White in 30 years, there's not a silver bullet thing that you do that makes it great. We still store our kegs upside down, by the way, because that we still don't have a permanent haze. Someday maybe we will as we continue to get better, but we have a, I don't know, semi-permanent haze, I guess I'd call it. It does pretty well, but if it's an account that they get that keg in and they put it in their cooler and they leave it upright, it doesn't matter how good a job we do, and if it sits in that cooler for a couple weeks or more before they tap it, like, it's gravity. It's going to get to us eventually. So, and we even see that. We make a hazy IPA as well that has great long-term stability, but even in that, we see if that keg sits upright for a while, you're still got settling. That's still going to happen. So, wish I had a perfect solution for it, but there's not. There's just a whole bunch of little small things you can do.
All right, I'm going to do our last question here, and then we're going to have a beer and do our raffle. Okay, so in what ways in America do you think the industry is changing to stay relevant and for breweries to stay alive?
I guess I'm holding this. That's tough. I don't know, because I think that what consumers want is changing too. So, like, the value proposition that craft brewers made originally is not necessarily meeting customers where they are. And I don't know if that's true. This is just like, and I'm getting over my skis a little bit maybe, but like, people like things that don't have as much flavor as we produce sometimes. And I mean, I'd say that's the majority of people. They sell a lot of Coors Light for a reason. I'm not saying we should start trying to compete with those breweries because that's not going to work, but realize that someone wants a premium product, but like, more flavor doesn't always bring the premium that they're looking for. So, I mean, I guess that's the best way to say it. And that's not a recipe design. Like, that's just an idea that, like, we can take in and consider.
I guess I think about it too. There's a lot of, you know, the alcohol industry is getting hit across the board, and there's a lot of beautiful wineries that have, you know, honed their craft, and, you know, it's all about their vineyard. It's all about the story. And, you know, I think in our market, you know, we have to just continue to hone our craft and look for the sustainability of what we're doing and continue to drive the interest, but create that community and that environment that brings, yeah, good relationships.
I think not just the US industry, but globally, there's a generation of people that are concerned about alcohol in general. And they're hearing either some really positive information about alcohol is not bad for you, beer is not bad for you because it's got lots of stuff in it that's good for you, versus other stories they're saying no alcohol is the only safe level. So they really are very concerned. They're staying away in general. So I'm not sure how we address that. I think we're a little bit unready as an industry to hit that head on and have a full-on promotional program but I personally feel that we could promote non-alcoholic beers differently. And if you've been to Germany, they promote low-alcohol beers as isotonic drinks. It's basically a health drink. And that's how Germany promote their low-alcohol beers. So I think the industry has to think broader about how we encourage that generation to get a positive feeling about alcohol in general, not just beer, but alcohol in general. And at the moment, I teach a really large class of 18 to 21-year-olds, and most of them say, we're not drinking any alcohol because we hear it's bad for you. So that, I think they're a fair representation of that generation. So, and when you talk about non-alcoholic beer, they think, oh, I didn't realise it had all these vitamins and all these sort of antioxidants and all these things. So I think we have to think more about that and how we deal with all that negative perception about alcohol.
Glenn, is that the whole argument? Is that principally what you're hearing? Are you also hearing, like, hey, I'm 18 years old, I have no money, like, I'm not going to pay $20
before back? Well, yeah, Molly's comment is about, oh, they just don't have any money. It's true, they're at college and they're at a really expensive college in California. So mum and dad are paying, probably. But they're getting stimulated in other ways, really stimulated in other ways, and also they're stimulated at home. They're not going out, and a recent study, I think, by the Beer Science Institute suggested that young men stay home, and their group of friends are on the internet who they're playing games with. They have no or very few personal friends. They're staying home. They don't want to go out, and they're having six Red Bulls or something like that while they're playing games for 6 hours. So there's been a whole shift in the lifestyle of this young generation. So there's so many factors, Molly, that they're thinking about. I think some of them are too concerned to go out, too afraid to go out. They don't want to be seen to be getting drunk or all those sorts of things because their face is on social media somewhere. And they're completely intimidated by that perception. I think this generation is, somebody said it before, is going to be the loneliest generation because they're not out socialising. And I don't have an answer to that yet. I would hope the industry is thinking about that because the generation coming behind them, they're only going to be hearing what the current generation's saying. I'm not sure old people like me can encourage the 15, 16, or whatever they are, the alphas or the betas or whatever, I don't know, to start drinking alcohol. And Laura said it, in China, they're not drinking that baijiu, which is their parents' drink. They're wanting to drink beer or whiskey. It's a totally different perception or perspective on what they want to do to entertain themselves. So if we're not thinking about it now, if we wait another 5 years to think about it, we might have missed another generation of people.
Well, let's see if I can end on a happier note. I mean, I don't disagree with anything that's been said. I've read all the same articles and seen all the same research, and I have 18 and 20-year-old kids, so I see it. Sample size of two, my 20-year-old who doesn't drink at all, still even in college, my 18-year-old, off the record, maybe does. So, you know, maybe we just need to wait a couple years. But what I really was going to say is I think we're craft brewers, right? Like there's only so much that we can do anyway. We're not going to stop people playing video games and gambling, like, or whatever the other thousand factors are that are out there. But I think we can continue to do what we've historically done well. And that's, you know, we're community organizations. We draw people into our spaces and we do sell flavor, and I'll take a little bit of a different approach than Ben. I agree that some of the flavors that we've done in the last 10 years aren't going to suit that generation. Hazy IPAs, you know, being probably one of them. But there are lots of other things that we can do. So I think listening to your consumer, making sure that we're making what they want to buy. Some of the stuff that sells best in our tasting room, you know, are flavors that I would have never thought to make. Until the last couple years. So I still think that craft brewers can compete on flavor. And yes, this, the data shows that people are drinking less in general in that generation, but it doesn't show that people aren't drinking. They are still, and in the right areas and for the right reasons and for the right things. So I think we can still lean into flavor, but not necessarily the flavors that brought us success in 2010 to 2019, right? So anyway, hope that's a little rosier.
Good job. Well, let's thank our panelists.